Welcome to the Laverne Cox Show, a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio.
Cis girls can take testosterone suppression if they have, you know, acne related to testosterone production. I mean, there's a million ways that endocrinologists will prescribe it, and it is simply not harmful, and it is simply being banned for only trans people, because the goal, once again, to come back to it, is not to protect anyone, it's to prevent us from being trans.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Laverne Cox Show. I'm Laverne Cox. When I think about this current cultural moment when it comes to trans people, I often think it's the best of times and the worst of times, to quote that famous book. There are more trans and non-binary characters on television. Lena Bloom became the first openly trans model on the cover of the Sports Illustrated Swimsuit Edition. I mean, come on. American Vogue finally had its first cover star, Ariel Nicholson. We had our first trans Olympians this year. But in this same year, an unprecedented number of anti-trans bills have been introduced in state legislatures targeting trans children. 35 states introduced over 100 pieces of legislation targeting mostly trans girls in sports and the ability of trans children to access gender-affirming health care. This discriminatory legislation is being crafted and financed by many conservative organizations and being relentlessly pushed through vitriolic, vicious misinformation and propaganda in mostly conservative media, but beyond. I am seeing no response at a comparable media level to the manufactured outrage and rhetoric that is doing harm to the lives of real trans people. This episode is about addressing misinformation, education, and correcting the record. And I have the absolute perfect guest for today's conversation. Chase Strangio is Deputy Director for Transgender Justice with the ACLU's LGBT and HIV Project and a nationally recognized expert on transgender rights. He was counsel in the challenge to Trump's trans military ban and the challenge to North Carolina's notorious anti-trans law, HB2, the bathroom bill, and counsel in a civil rights case of transgender employment discrimination that went to the Supreme Court and won. He is currently counsel in the ACLU's challenges to anti-trans laws in Idaho and Arkansas. Please enjoy my conversation with Chase Strangio. We just want to give you a quick trigger warning. This episode includes conversations about discrimination against trans people and specifically trans children. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, 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 Chase Strangio. Welcome to the podcast. How are you feeling today, darling?
Well, it is really nice to see you and be here with you. So that is making me feel good. And I'm doing okay. You know, it's a rainy day here in New York. Staying inside. How are you?
Staying inside sounds like the story of the past year and a half.
Yeah.
I'm good, but I'm actually kind of nervous about this conversation today because I've never done a podcast quite like this, because I try to shield myself from negative media coverage of trans people. I try not to engage in those arguments. And then I don't want to use my public platform to add to the noise of the us versus them, to the noise that further divides us. I always want to come from a place of love, loving individuals and being critical of policies and mindsets and ideologies. So I'm nervous because I don't want this podcast to be used as part of some sort of culture war thing. It just feels like a cesspool. So I'm nervous, but I think we can do this if we come from our shared deep love of trans people, our deep love of justice for everyone and not doing harm, you know? So yeah, that was a long, like, how I'm doing.
No, but I mean, I hear that. And I, you know, bless you for bringing me on if you're trying to avoid the cesspool. But I do think that, you know, I too share that vision, that goal. And I, you know, I I do sort of hope for a time when it is, you know, not seen as politically controversial or cause for backlash to simply just show up and say, you know, I love being trans. I love trans people, because I think that is where we're coming from. But even that, I think in this moment that we're in, has become a site of contestation. The idea that we should be allowed to love ourselves and tell people that we do is controversial. And that is troubling. And I think that's, you know, the sad reality of where we are.
Yeah. And I think ignoring it, for me, I can't ignore it any longer, because it, this year has been, correct me if I'm wrong, there have been more legislative attacks on trans people in state legislatures this year than ever. Am I right? I know there's been a lot over the years. Is this like, is this comparable, or is this the most?
This is definitely the most. So both in terms of, I would say, you know, net numbers, were definitely, you know, far exceeding anything in terms of number of anti-trans bills introduced in 2021. I would say it's the most in terms of how many bills actually advanced in state legislatures. So, you know, many, many more than we typically see ended up passing out of one chamber. Most of them got hearings. These were not just throwaway bills. These were bills that were being moved, considered, publicly debated, and then more became law than in the past 10 years combined in this single year. So we are facing an escalation that is, is staggering.
Staggering indeed. And we learned in Disclosure, my documentary on Netflix, that the media plays a huge part in public perceptions of trans people. And what we're seeing from mostly conservative right-wing media about trans people is deeply disturbing. But what inspired this podcast is I was watching the Bill Maher show a few weeks ago, August 6, 2021. And he did a segment with Donna DeVerono that was supposed to be about trans people at the Olympics. But I was very disturbed by it.
I mean, this is the first year that trans athletes have been allowed in the Olympics. Just now, as they're wrapping up, what I read is they didn't do it too good.
So he goes on to talk more about the trans folks who competed in the Olympics this year. But I just wanted to stop there, because that's factually incorrect. So I think it's important to point out that that's factually incorrect, because trans people have actually been eligible to compete in the Olympics since 2004, right? Since 2004, the International Olympic Committee has had standards in place where trans people can compete. In 2015, the International Olympic Committee amended their guidelines, and this year is the first year trans people have qualified. So I think when we say, in the context of a lot of media being anti-trans women in sports, saying this is the first time trans people are allowed to compete, it supports a narrative that, like, there's something going on that's new and weird and strange when trans people have been able to compete for a really long time. And that's why I wanted to highlight that moment. What do you have to say about that, Chase?
Yeah, I mean, almost every piece on trans people, period, on a trans athlete specifically, is just full of misinformation. And I think the challenge we're facing in this moment is that the right-wing media, the anti-trans media, is covering trans issues 100 times more frequently than, you know, any other media source. And so what we get is we are inundated with factual misinformation, deliberately told lies, but that are presented with such certainty over and over again. And so even just something as simple as when trans people could begin competing in the Olympics, that is easily verifiable. And what Bill Maher said was factually wrong. And of course, it goes on from there. And many, many more factual errors are in that episode, as is true in every single episode of media attacking trans people.
And I think what, in the sports piece, right, the ground that anti-trans legislation has been able to gain has been around specifically trans girls in sports. I believe it's 9 bills now, right? When I say girls, I mean girls under the age of 18. Am I correct with that?
Yes. So there's 9 states that ban trans athletes from sports, and they have some variation. Some of them go up to college. So, you know, for example, Idaho, which was the first state to ban trans women and girls from sports, was a ban from kindergarten through the collegiate level. Mm-hmm. And then there are a few of the bills, Tennessee, for example, that bans all trans people. So it does actually cover trans boys as well. But it's largely, we're largely talking about girls, and we're largely talking about the K through 12 context.
Yeah. And that is mostly what we see, like, debate after debate in conservative media about fairness and trans women in sports. And what I will say about that is that, I'll say a couple of things. So trans women have been able to compete in the Olympics for the past 15 years. This is the first year we've actually had a trans woman compete. Laurel Hubbard, the trans woman who competed in weightlifting, she's a New Zealand weightlifter, failed to make her lifts and didn't even medal, right? So the science is still, there's not enough studies that have been done on actual trans people and whether we have an advantage or a disadvantage. But empirically, there's probably about a handful of trans people who in high school sports and other sports who have won. And then those trans women are constantly cited when we talk about trans women in sports and whether it's fair or not. But empirically, since trans folks have been able to play, trans women are not taking over women's sports.
Yeah, I mean, separate and apart from getting into the minutiae of, you know, the science of our bodies, the science of testosterone, all the conversations about that, I think your point is an incredibly important one, which is that it is not new that trans women and girls have been competing in women and girls sports, not just at the Olympic level. We have had the NCAA across the United States, hundreds of thousands of athletes total competing in colleges and universities in the United States. Trans people have been included through the current policy for a decade. And when I go to testify in these state legislatures, when I listen to all of these conversations about trans dominance, they can point to a grand total of 2 collegiate trans athletes who have even won anything. That's out of, you know, if you think about the hundreds and thousands of collegiate athletes that have gone through these systems. And so that is a percentage that is close to zero. And same when you look at the K through 12 level. So we have states across the country that allow trans inclusion, you know, based on gender identity. California has a state law that was passed in 2014 that requires trans inclusion based on gender identity and athletics. I have never, and that is a huge state, I've never even heard of a trans athlete winning anything in California. So what we know is that we have at least a decade, in some cases 2 decades of experience, no dominance of any kind. And yet we have these handful of examples that become weaponized to tell a story that is based on fear and misinformation to make people reflexively feel like trans people are dominating. And what is so scary about that is not really trans people winning sporting events. It's the sort of specter of transness and being confronted with trans people in our bodies. And that is sort of what we're being fed over and over and over again. Because when we listen into these debates, for example, 35 states introduced bills attempting to ban trans women and girls from sports. All of these hearings, you would seriously think that LeBron James is stepping on a 7th grade basketball court with girls. That's how they're talking about this. This isn't a real conversation that we're having. And I think we have to sort of take down the temperature and really remind ourselves of what's going on here.
And I think why the sports thing has caught on so strongly is because when we talk about sports and we talk about physical advantages, then we have to talk about bodies mm-hmm. and strength, and then we can reduce trans people to bodies. And I have been saying since I've had a public platform, it's when we reduce trans people to surgery transition, bodies, body parts, chromosomes, we are objectifying trans people. We reduce them to a body part, to a limb, to a chromosome. We are objectifying them. And when we objectify people, we're dehumanizing them. And so that has been the most disturbing part for me, and partly why I haven't wanted to talk about this publicly, is because it is so dehumanizing. And I don't want to engage in conversations that dehumanize trans people. And what I also find curious is that with most of the anti-trans sports bills that have been introduced, many of them have been accompanied by bans on gender-affirming care for trans kids. And I literally was thinking, like, wait a minute. what is undisputed is that most of the advantage that a trans person would have, or that someone assigned male at birth would have, would happen after puberty. If trans girls have access to puberty blockers, there's absolutely no advantage. So while puberty blockers and, you know, gender-affirming care isn't the right answer for every trans youth, I'm not saying that's the case. I think that is something that should be decided between the trans youth, their parent, and their doctor. But if we make that care available and the trans kids who want to have puberty blockers have access to it, then the whole question of an advantage with children at least becomes moot.
Yeah, I mean, and I think this is a reminder again that it's not about protecting women's sports. It's not about competitive advantage. Because when you look at what's happening, these bills are being introduced together.
Yep.
These bills at their core are about stopping people from being trans, which of course you cannot do other than by killing them. But that is the goal here. It's written right into the preamble of the healthcare bills. It is inherently harmful to be trans. We want to stop kids from having access to transition because they're more likely to become trans adults. And they're introducing these bills in conjunction with each other because it situates the conversation on the body, like you said. It forces people to have a conversation about kids' bodies, which nobody should be having in the way that they are. It is incredibly creepy. It's opening the door to a host of regulations of children's bodies that everyone should be very much afraid of. You know, trans kids and cis kids, like all of these bills have mechanisms for enforcement that could seriously erode the privacy and bodily autonomy protections of young women and girls in particular. But ultimately, you know, these are pre-drafted bills, part of a well-coordinated movement that are designed for the sole and exclusive purpose at their core to stop kids from being trans at all.
Yeah. Yeah. There, I think it was in Florida where I don't know if the bill passed or not, but if I recall correctly, if a child's gender was in question, their genitals could be inspected and chromosome test. I can't even like saying it out loud feels like I feel like I need to take a shower.
Yes, we should all be. This is like really just like such a violation that we would be doing this in the name of protecting anyone is dystopian, you know. Well, so Florida passed an anti-trans sports bill. They had multiple. One of the versions, I think the one that you're referring to, had in it this panel of physicians that could be convened to inspect the records and bodies of young people to quote unquote determine who was eligible to play. And again, we have to remind ourselves that, you know, trans people are an incredibly small percentage of the population. And we are already pushed out of school and sports at incredibly high rates. So what these bills are largely doing are two things. It, you know, first is just entrenching discriminatory norms of sex that ultimately are designed to, you know, hurt trans people across the board. But second is expanding the power of the state to surveil all the bodies of young athletes. And because most young athletes are going to be cis, it's going to hurt them.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is just, you know, one of the things that has really been lost in this conversation is that, you know, the policing of particularly cis young women and girls of color in sports is so high. The scrutiny of their bodies, especially if you look at Black young women and professional athletes who are Black.
Absolutely.
You know, you have high rates of policing. They're, you know, subject to extra scrutiny, extra drug testing. You know, the intended targets, of course, are trans people, but the impact will be felt for many other people. And I think, that is really troubling. And all of the bills, like the Florida one that you alluded to, do have some sort of enforcement mechanism that authorizes the state to inquire in one way or another into the genitals, the reproductive anatomy, and the chromosomes of children. Mm. And if you think about the context that we're living in right now, where on the one hand, you have the Supreme Court eroding abortion rights left and right, the ability to control one's body being eroded left or right, while at the same time, you know, we're having conversations about mask mandates infringing upon people's bodily autonomy. There's a core hypocrisy in all of this. And in some ways, trans people are the canaries in the coal mine, because we have been one of the first lines of attack in so many of these state legislatures over the past 5 years. And we're only seeing the expansion of those types of attack. And I think it's incredibly concerning to see how easy it's been for states to move these anti-trans sports bills, given the degree to which they intrude upon the bodies and the autonomy and the self-determination of children in schools.
And I think part of it is the media has a lot to cover, but the media is not covering it. Mm-hmm. And our LGBTQ plus organizations are not pressuring the media to cover it. So a lot of people don't even know that it's going on. I want to go to the next clip. And it's a moment on Ben Shapiro's show. He recently did a debate with scientist Neil deGrasse Tyson. And I want to play this clip because I think it sets us up nicely for the rest of the conversation.
My general take on all of this stuff, from climate change to gender dysphoria to all these issues, is bring out the science and then let's hash it out. I think that the problem I'm seeing on a lot of sides
is, what is your motivation?
Why does that matter?
It matters because if you have political power, you could end up creating legislation that subtracts freedoms from people who previously were enjoying the same freedoms as you. The history of that exercise
then make a better argument.
Doesn't end well.
I encourage people to go and watch the clip. It's from the July 18th, 2021 episode of The Ben Shapiro Show on YouTube. But what was really interesting about the debate is that Ben Shapiro is often sort of citing science and biology. And what I loved about Neil deGrasse Tyson's argument is like, well, what's your motivation? It's like science has historically been used to take away people's liberties, right? But I think for me, the science question around trans people is utterly and completely irrelevant. In most situations, we don't know people's genitalia. We don't know their chromosomes. If you listen to a Ben Shapiro, episode, he's constantly talking about men and women based on chromosomes and genitalia and the capacity to reproduce. And these are things that are not things that we interact with. I walk down the street or I like interact with, I have no idea what someone's genitals are. And the space of using science to take away people's liberties is really a huge part of what the talking points in conservative media are about. Can you talk to us a little bit about your understanding from a legal perspective around how biology and biological sex are used and weaponized against trans folks?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's such an important point, not to say that we should abandon science, but we should always be asking the question, what is our motivation for utilizing what we're claiming is a scientific discourse and why? And I think, when you look at the history of the regulation of trans people in the law, what you see is that the very first time in the United States that biological sex as a term was used in the law was in 2016 when North Carolina passed HB2. There was no biological sex as a legal concept. There was sex. And in fact, in the law, sex and gender are used interchangeably. We talk about protections based on sex, which include sex stereotypes. There was no concept of biological sex.
So when you say there's no such thing as biological sex, you're talking in legal terms and the idea of biological sex being a recent phenomenon.
Yeah.
Am I correct?
Yeah, it's a recent phenomenon that emerged for the sole and exclusive purpose to exclude trans people from space. That it emerged with the bathroom bills. And it's now being used in healthcare bans, in sports bans, and locker room bans, and bans on pronoun use. And the reason why I say it doesn't exist is because it's an ever-changing concept in the law whose definition changes so that it can always mean not trans people. Protections for anyone, but not trans people. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the best examples of this was in Gavin Grimm's case in Gloucester County, Virginia, when Gavin's in high school in 2015, and they, seek to ban him from the restroom after he uses it for a period of time, just because he's a young man who's trans. They pass a policy saying that you can only use restrooms based on quote unquote biological gender.
Did they say biological gender or biological sex?
In this case, they say biological gender. So again, these are folks who are just flying around with terms, they're Googling things. Who knows where they're getting it? So in the 6 years that we litigated Gavin's case, they changed the definition of biological gender repeatedly. It was never defined, by the way, in the policy.
Wow.
And it took many forms. So first it was, it's your genitals. And then it's like, actually, no, it's your birth certificate. But when Gavin changed his birth certificate, they're like, actually, it's not the birth certificate. It's surgery. And then when Gavin had surgery, they're like, actually, it's not surgery. It's chromosomes. And then in, you know, the course of litigation, when they were claiming that the interest that they were protecting was privacy, they couldn't explain how chromosomes connected to privacy. And so they kept changing the definition again. And so I think what we have to remember is biological gender, biological sex as legal terms are moving targets that are constantly being reshaped to hurt trans people. They're weaponized against trans people, and they have no history in American law. And so when we hear those words, we have to ask ourselves, why is this being deployed? And who is it intending to hurt?
This is a good time to take a little break. We're back. In a piece you wrote titled, "There's No Such Thing as a Male Body," which I love, you wrote, "At birth, we classify infants as male or female based solely on the appearance of their external genitalia. Notably, this classification serves population control and surveillance and not medical purposes. The medical experts I have spoken with could not identify a single medical purpose for assigning sex at birth and explain that the components of sex are far more complex than just external genitalia and include at least chromosomes, genes, hormones, internal genitalia, gender identity, and secondary sex characteristics. By embracing a narrative that one is born with a male body, we reinforce the idea that only the bodies we assign at birth, bodies that have medically normative penises, are male." I love that. It actually sort of, I think that can take us into the next clip, actually. This is from Bill Maher's show, August 6, 2021, Real Time with Bill Maher.
In the guidance on the Olympic coverage that Fox Sports put out, listen to the statement. "No one is born with a gender identity. Everyone is born a baby and their gender is assigned to them by doctors." This attempt to make, overturn the whole world and pretend that this is something that we just, a penis, well, it could be an indicator of anything.
Exactly.
I mean, that's funny. Yeah. A penis, it could be an indicator of anything. What I love about that is, like, I'm like, yeah, it actually can be. Like, what's the problem? For me, what's the problem? I think this whole thing around a penis being destiny. I mean, so much of the anxiety usually is not about men with vaginas. It's usually about, like, the possibility of a woman with a penis. And people are just really, really terrified of the idea of a woman with a penis or having once had one. And so to also just break down what happened there, Bill Maher conflated gender identity and sex assigned at birth. So we have sex assigned at birth based on genitalia, as we just heard from your piece. And then we have gender. Our sociologists for years have said that gender is an understanding of, like, how we express ourselves in terms of being male, female, both or neither. And it's different in every culture. It's different in different times. And so gender is something that is socially constructed. For the most part, most people, their gender aligns with the sex that they're assigned at birth. But for some people, trans folks, non-binary people, our gender doesn't align, and we do things or don't do things to make ourselves more integrated. And so the conflation, it's so weird, because I was like, a few years ago, I was like, I'm done with the trans 101. But apparently we can't be done with the trans 101 when we have statements like that that conflate gender identity with sex assigned at birth. And I think that the whole thing of, like, is it possible to move away from the penis is destiny? Because when we say, like, you're born this way, it's just based on external genitalia. And we are so much more than that. Men, women, non-binary people are so much more than, like, what's between our legs that a doctor decides at birth. Like, my empathetic part of it is like, oh my God, I've been saying this for years. The first thing we ask when someone is pregnant is, like, is it a boy or a girl? And so there's something so fundamental about it. And I guess it's destabilizing for people to think of the presence of a penis and not automatically think that the person who might have that is male. But like, for me, I go to the real lived experiences of trans people, right? Even if that's like a weird concept for you, right? If we love trans people and if we respect trans people and believe they're deserving of respect and love, it means that we respect how they identify themselves. So when a trans woman says that she's a woman, we respect that. We believe them when they say who they are. That trans woman might have a penis. So then, you know, a Bill Maher or a Ben Shapiro might say we're insane. That's what they say. They say that trans people are crazy. But if we don't pathologize trans people and believe that we are who we say we are and love and respect us, then we must think differently about the presence of a penis and a vagina in a baby when that baby is born, taking into consideration the existence of trans people, the fact that we manifest. And so this means, yes, a penis can be an indication of many things.
Well said, and how important, because I think the sort of deeply entrenched sort of structural myth that a penis must be an indicator of maleness and a vagina must be an indicator of femaleness is the animating driver of this notion of transness as fraud. The idea that if you are a trans person, you are concealing something from the world, and that the exposing that becomes also the source of an incredible amount of violence. The idea that if someone is discovered to have body parts that don't line up with our story that we tell ourselves in this country and in this world about, you know, how these body parts have to align with someone's identification and external presentation. And we've essentially sort of created the conditions that excuse people violently enacting, you know, their resistance to that concept on people's bodies.
And so much of this, let's go into the next clip and then we'll talk, because I think it's talking about having a conversation about language is a deeper conversation about language. It's Ben Shapiro chatting with Blair White, and the clip is from Blair White's YouTube channel from a January 10th, 2018 episode titled Debate, Ben Shapiro and Blair White.
You know, I'm the editor of a pretty major site, and my basic rule is that when we're discussing people who are trans, we immediately say in the first paragraph, trans woman, and then refer to them by their biological pronoun, because biology is the nature of the pronoun.
This is a special Ben Shapiro moment. Biology is the nature of the pronoun. I guess we are assigned pronouns at birth too, huh?
This is not to, you know, again, I don't want to deride Mr. Shapiro. I don't know him, but biology is the nature of the pronoun is hilarious. That is really, really funny. And then also, in another interview with Joe Rogan, Mr. Shapiro says that he will call Caitlyn Jenner, but he will not call Caitlyn Jenner she, because you can change your name and you can't change your sex. He says that Caitlyn Jenner is a man, she has male chromosomes, blah, 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 that sort of argument. And then what's actually really beautiful, I encourage people to go and watch ContraPoint's video titled Pronouns, published on November 2nd, 2018 on YouTube, because she talks about that this is really about language and how we assign meaning. We assign meaning to body parts. So I think what I want to say about pronouns, and I've been saying this for years, is that misgendering trans people, I've said that it's an act of violence, and I've been criticized for that. And I always talk about there's different kinds of violence. There's structural violence, there's direct violence, there's systemic violence, there's different kinds of violence. And oftentimes when we misgender trans folks, it's in the context of my life, it's often led to my safety being in question when someone has called me a man on the street, or that's a dude. It's being yelled at me, and it feels very much like I need to get out of there, or I might, you know, get beaten up or killed. Beyond the disrespect is the insisting that trans people are always and only the gender we were assigned at birth. You know, people have asked me, what's the biggest, you know, thing that trans people have to face? And it's really that. And it's baked into all of this that trans people can never really be who we say we are based on some genitalia that a doctor, you know, assigns meaning to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's obviously the ways in which, like, people accidentally mispronoun people all the time, cis people and trans people, and that's, you know, part of life.
And that's, and want to give people grace. I'm not into attacking people if they get someone's pronoun wrong, but, you know, try.
Yeah, like, try, and then also, we're not talking about casual misgendering in a lot of these contexts. We are talking about the deliberate and repeated insistence as, you know, of referring to individuals by their assigned sex at birth, despite the fact that they are telling us who they are. And this idea that trans people simply cannot know who we are, and that who we know ourselves to be is actually a delusion. I mean, that's what we're seeing in litigation now, is the argument that, you know, affirming a trans person is akin to feeding a delusion. And the arguments that are being leveraged largely against trans young people, you know, because that's where we're seeing, you know, the majority of these state legislative attacks, and the insistence in legislative hearings talking about trans girls repeatedly as not just biological males, as boys, over and over again, to send a message that we will never see you for who you are. And we are working day and night to entrench a set of policies to not only push you out of spaces with your peers, but to create governmental interests that are essentially that it is harmful for you to be you. And then that gives the power of the state to then come in and try to stop people from being trans. And so I see the misgendering as part and parcel to that erasure of the dignity of trans people, of our ability to have legal protections, and of our humanity, full stop. And that, I think, is what we're seeing, you know, in court, in legal papers, in briefs, you know, in the context of these healthcare bans. There's, you know, this incredibly patronizing and misogynist discourse about the idea that, quote unquote, girls are being pressured into transition, and that we're losing lesbians, we're losing, you know, we're losing tomboys all to this, you know, sort of mass hysteria of transition. And in the process, the repeated reference to trans boys as girls, as biological girls, as girls who are mutilating their bodies by having top surgery, for example, is so deliberate. It is so calculated. And it is not simply about language. It's not about, oh, well, I want to use a particular language. It's about weaponizing language in the service of a very scary project to inhibit the ability of trans people to survive.
And that's why it's violent.
It has a eugenics undertone and a eugenics impulse, because what we're seeing now over and over again is the idea that the goal of this legislation is to decrease the number of trans people that there are. And when you have government...
Can we just actually pause? The goal of this legislation is to decrease the number of trans people that there are. I think that we just need to let that settle in for a second. That's clearly the truth. Please continue, Chase.
Yeah. And when you have governments, you know, being pushed by global well-funded movements to enact policies to decrease the numbers of a population, that is a eugenics program at core. And that is what we're up against. And they are tapping into people's fears. They are using tools like the systemic misgendering of people, trying to appeal to notions of science and notions of biology and things that we reflexively believe because we're taught our whole lives, which is that there are two sexes and that we can easily identify them. But that isn't true as a scientific matter. That isn't true as a legal matter. And that just simply isn't true as a social matter. And so I think that, yes, the world, as you know, it's like why Bill Maher was like, oh, these people are trying to overturn everything in the world. It's like, in maybe in your world, the things that are important to you, Bill Maher, are being challenged. That doesn't mean that the world is being overturned. You know, our norms change over time about everything. You know, it's like people in the United States used to drink and smoke cigarettes when they were pregnant, and then they didn't. You know, it's like we were instructed all the time about what is good and bad. Everything changes.
And I think that should not be a threat to you if you are secure in who you are. I think there's two things going on. I think some people, trans people, invite them to question their own gender. I think too, honestly, in a patriarchal culture, I can't help but think that that's part of the anxiety too. It is part of the anxiety that men want to know for sure that the person he's womanizing on the street was assigned female at birth. And so there's this whole other element, I think, to this, where it's like,
people want this certainty around gender because it's also about power. Some people are uncomfortable because they don't want to think about all this stuff, but I think sometimes it's about power, and we, in the intersectional nature of how all this works, cannot be overlooked. On an episode of 60 Minutes that aired on May 23rd, there was a lot of controversy around it. It was a segment done by Leslie Stahl that focused on detransitioners, those folks who undergo gender transition, regret it, and transition back. The segment got a lot of backlash. Opponents of the segment feared that it would be used to invalidate trans identity by anti-trans forces. I spoke out about the episode at the time because I felt once again in the media we were reducing trans identity to transition, hormones, and surgery. Detransitioners felt that there were attempts to silence them and their experience. What are your thoughts on that 60 Minutes segment, and then the way in which detransition can be used in this current environment of the proliferation of anti-trans legislation?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is incredibly, you know, complicated conversation, in part because it's not about, you know, who gets to tell their story. It's about why our story is being told and how. Because right now we don't live in a world that stops people from detransitioning. We live in a world that is invested in people not being trans. And so what these stories are being used for, and what the media is capitalizing on, is this larger narrative that trans people regret their transition and are harmed by being trans. And so it's playing right in to the fundamental premise of every piece of legislation that we're fighting against, because ultimately what they're trying to do, and frankly, they did this in the abortion context too, with abortion regret, which is to say, there are a very, very, very small number of people who didn't get the care they wanted, regretted the care they had. And within that very, very small number of people, there's an even smaller number of them who are invested in using their stories to harm trans people. There are many who just go about their lives. And then there's the small number of the already small number. And it gets just like the trans athletes who are good at sports, of which there is an incredibly small number. It gets completely oversaturated in the media, becomes disproportionately talked about, so that there is a sense that transition, that gender affirmation is harmful, and that kids are being rushed into it. And that is a problem for so many reasons, because first, it is already incredibly difficult to get access to gender affirming care,
yes,
in this country,
yes,
and around the world. And so this idea that people, you know, and that, you know, they'll find people to say, oh, I walked into, you know, they make it sound like you can walk into a CVS and get puberty blockers.
Well, the 60 Minutes segment featured a number of trans people who said after two therapy sessions, they were given testosterone. I think there were televisits, and they were given testosterone after two visits. And after three, one of the detransitioners said that they went to have an orchiectomy, right? So one detransitioner said that they transitioned and detransitioned within the space of a year, right? That once they had their top surgery, they started having this feeling of regret or whatever. So I think about that, and I'm just, I've been in this game for a minute. I'm like, where did you go where you could get? No. I know a lot of trans people. I don't know anybody who's like gotten,
yeah,
hormones that legally that quickly.
And you certainly can't get them without your parents. And there's a huge process, and there's tons of bureaucracy, and insurance doesn't always cover it. And it's a huge fight. So the idea that we're, you know, and yes, there may be a few examples, like with anything, like of care being administered unaccountably, in ways that, you know, someone wasn't, you know, properly diagnosed. That's true of every single medical condition. That's just always going to be true. But, you know, it's like if someone's misdiagnosed with cancer and given the wrong treatment, it's a tragedy, but we don't stop cancer treatment as writ large. We just simply don't engage with medicine that way. And when you think about the fact that, you know, there's not a 60 Minutes special about all of the people who were lucky enough to have access to gender affirming care as young people and how it saved their lives, and that how harmful it is for these bans to be coming out and what it will do to kids to have their care cut off. Like, why in a moment?
I would love to see that segment.
And we are not seeing that segment. And we are, but in the midst of this set of attacks, what we're hearing is about how there's people who regret their transition, how people rush into transition. That feeds right into the narrative that we are fighting in state legislatures, that we are fighting in court. We hear from the same quote-unquote detransitioners in every single piece of litigation who claim that, you know, it wasn't right for them and that it should be available to no one. And, you know, if you are using your personal experience to take away legal protections, to take away healthcare for other people, then I think I have a lot of questions for you about why that is your journey. But at the end of the day, it's not about restricting people's stories. It's about asking why we hear disproportionately about something that is so rare.
Yeah.
In a moment when, you know, we're fighting so hard just to maintain the already meager healthcare that we are able to get. And in the context of these, you know, attacks on trans youth in particular and the medical care that, you know, many trans young people need, there is such an incredible amount of distortion about the science and what we know to be true about this care, which is that it is, you know, safe in the case of blockers, it is reversible, and in the case of all of it, it is effective, and that almost no one regrets the treatment percentage wise. That doesn't mean you can't find people, but in terms of percentages, this care is incredibly effective insofar as, you know, you have people for whom this is the difference between life or death, that their dysphoria, their distress goes down so significantly when they have access to this care. And what we're seeing is states trying to ban it, some states trying to criminalize it, using these very rare circumstances in which people regret some aspect of their care as a justification. And I think that's really scary.
What's deep to me is that someone would have their detransition experience and say no one should be to experience this. That's just, I'm just trying to wrap my head around that. And it's just, I in preparing for this, I did watch a documentary where someone who had detransitioned and he was on a mission, you know, to make sure that other people didn't. Which makes me so sad because I think about my own life and how life-saving my transition was. It really was, and how happy I was, even as I struggled, even before I was like famous Laverne Cox, and I was struggling to pay rent and, like, you know, doing my thing in New York. But I was so much happier in my truth mm-hmm. than I was trying to live a lie. And it was just wonderful. I mean, I'm not saying my life has been easy. Discrimination is awful. It sucks. And that's real. But I wouldn't trade myself.
Yeah.
I wouldn't trade being myself. You know, we change the discrimination. We don't, like, you know, we stay ourselves. So and everyone's story, I've personally known people who've detransitioned, and that was the right thing for them. But I think for me, the bigger thing that we haven't said is that the state should not be involved in medical decisions that people make about their bodies. I think that is, I need to drive that home. I believe in bodily autonomy. I'm pro-choice. I don't think the state should be involved in making decisions about people's bodies. If they're children, it should be between the child, their parent, and their doctor. If we're adults, it should be between our doctor and us. And the government really, it's really not the government's business. I mean, I think it's also important to state that we're just sort of being used as a political football as well. Like, there are real consequences to this. We're real people, but we're also just being used because the Republican Party has nothing really to offer beyond these sort of cultural battles. I mean, like, their legislative agenda in state legislatures this year has been critical race theory, voter suppression, and trans bills.
Yeah, I mean, and that's what we're seeing over and over again. And I think that when you look at, you know, the way these bills are being pushed, and that's true of all three of those categories, a lot of times you're seeing them being pushed through in a matter of hours. And what that is signaling is that, you know, people aren't debating them. People aren't looking at studies. They're getting pre-drafted bills from groups that are solely committed to this, drafting the bills, shipping them out. And then, you know, lawmakers who are afraid of being primaried from the right, just speaking out about how they hate trans people. They don't know what they're talking about 90% of the time, especially in these healthcare bills. I mean, they couldn't even pronounce the care that they were banning because they didn't sit with it. They didn't know. And it wasn't like there were a bunch of people calling up lawmakers in Arkansas and being like, you know, the most important thing to me as your constituent is to make sure no one gets puberty blockers. That is not the crisis that people are contending with in mass in the middle of a pandemic. It is now a crisis because there's hundreds of trans kids who might lose their care. But, you know, again, these are very specific, you know, politically motivated attacks that unfortunately have devastating and catastrophic harms.
Absolutely. Let's go to the next clip from the Joe Rogan Experience, August 2nd, 2017.
Now, when people say that there's this 40% suicide rate amongst transgender people, one of the arguments that I've heard is it's because they're not accepted.
Right. I've heard this too. Yeah.
Yeah. And that if they were accepted and then they felt themselves and they felt loved for their true self, then it would be just like everybody else.
And but I've seen no evidence to suggest that. If there is a decrease based on treatment, then it's marginal at best.
What do you have to say to that, Chase?
Oh my God, so many things. So again, going back to like, coming back to the core of what we're seeing right now, again, is there is a desire to cast transness as inherently harmful. So they are invested in a narrative that it is harmful to be us. And then their solution to that is to make fewer trans people. So they use this rhetoric of actually transition doesn't help. It's still harmful. So we should intervene. And even in the sports bills, in our litigation in Idaho, for example, you know, they're arguing that the law doesn't actually harm our trans plaintiff because, according to them, you know, quote, and I'm reading now from ADF's brief in the District of Idaho in our Hecox v. Little case, saying, quote, many studies document that those who persist in living in a transgender identity into adulthood suffer severely poor mental and physical health throughout their lifetimes, even after, quote, transition, quote, affirmation and cross-sex hormones, and even after so-called sex reassignment surgery. As a result, Hecox can show no likelihood of tangible harm from the law. And this is what we're seeing over and over again, that the harm is being trans and there is no benefit to the care. And they're lying. Yes. I mean, they're lying in a number of different ways. And I think it's really important. First,
that's why I brought the clip, because it's real bad. It's dangerous as fuck.
It's dangerous as fuck. Because so there's a number of ways they're using this statistic. But one of the lies that they're sort of they cite a lot to this Swedish study, which is from, I think, 2011, that, you know, essentially has certain conclusions about the mental health outcomes post-surgery from a cohort of people. And the numbers that they often cite to compare the mental health outcomes for the trans population post-surgery to cis people, not to trans people who did not have surgery. And so, yes, trans people have worse mental health outcomes often than cis people, even after transition in many cases, because we experience discrimination and violence. And that is to be expected. But that does not mean that the gender transition, that the gender affirmation, that the healthcare that we're receiving made us worse. It just didn't bring us to our cis peers. However, those are studies about surgery on adults over a decade ago, not the data that we currently have about affirming youth. And that data shows unequivocally that, in fact, if you affirm young people in their identity through whatever is medically indicated, whether that's blockers or social transition or hormones, that you do see mental health outcomes comparable to their cis peers. And again, we have the possibility to improve the mental health outcomes for younger people in ways we didn't in the hostile world that are, you know, adults were living in, that the, you know, older studies are documenting. But even those older studies aren't saying that the care made us worse. And the study authors themselves say, do not use this study to claim that the surgery was not effective. And yet here we are, and one of the main right-wing talking points, despite the study itself, despite the very clear language, is to say that the care itself is harmful and that being trans is harmful and there's nothing you can do about it. So the goal should be to stop people from being trans.
So after listening to this episode and Chase bringing up this Swedish study specifically, I thought it was really important to include a clip from Tucker Carlson where he cites this Swedish study. So our next clip is from Tucker Carlson, posted on YouTube on May 25th, 2021, titled, Most Americans Aren't Aware of the Research.
Researchers in Sweden found the same thing. After 10 years of study, the Swedes concluded that people who underwent sex reassignment surgery were 19% more likely to commit suicide. The risk of psychiatric hospitalization was nearly three times greater. In other words, it was an utter disaster.
So to listen to the Tucker Carlson clip as it is, suggest that if you are trans and you have gender affirming care, that you're 19 times more likely to commit suicide than if you don't. That is the suggestion that Tucker Carlson is making. But what he is misstating based on the study is that he what the study is doing, and Chase points this out, is that the flaw in the study is that they're not comparing the psychological and emotional health of trans people who underwent gender-confirming surgery with trans people who did not undergo gender-confirming surgery. They're comparing trans people with non-trans people. So Tucker Carlson in this moment is misstating the actual results of the study that he is citing, first of all. And to read from the study itself, and Chase alludes to this, the authors concluded, though, that the evidence base for sex reassignment is of very low quality due to the serious methodological limitations of included studies. The methodological shortcomings have many reasons. First, the nature of sex reassignment precludes double-blind, randomized control studies of the results. Second, transsexualism is rare, and many follow-ups are hampered by small numbers of subjects. Third, many sex reassigned persons decline to participate in follow-up studies or relocate after surgery, resulting in high dropout rates and subsequent selection bias. Fourth, several follow-up studies are hampered by limited follow-up periods. Taken together, these limitations preclude solid and generalizable conclusions. A long-term population-based control study is one way to address these methodological shortcomings. So again, this is from the Swedish study itself, which concedes the methodological limitations of the study itself. It says that we basically need more research. And just from my own personal experience, this study was done about 10 years ago. When a lot of trans people transition, historically, the standards of care suggested that you transition and then you do not talk about being trans anymore. You change location so that no one else ever knows that you're trans. This was the medical protocol for decades. And one of the things, I just wanted, as a side note, data inclusion and data collection around trans people is sorely inadequate. There's so much data that we don't have on trans people. We don't actually even count the numbers of trans people in the United States because we don't include us in the census. So whenever a conservative commentator is citing science, they're citing science from really limited research. So referring to this Swedish study and making it, seem as if trans people are more likely to commit suicide after sex reassignment surgery is misinformation, it's misuse of this study, and it is dangerous. Now, back to our regular scheduled programming.
And this type of distortion of what studies are showing, it is done incredibly effective by the right. And it is incredibly insidious. And and it's so upsetting because as trans people, we know we're like, our people do better when we get our healthcare.
Absolutely. And so there's a couple things that came up for me there. The U.S. Trans Survey, the latest one that says like 41% of trans folks have attempted suicide in our lifetime. I believe it's a GLSEN study that said that 50% of trans young people have attempted suicide. This is in our lifetime, right? There's no statistics anywhere that cite a suicide rate of trans people after we transition. And this is an attempt of suicide. I'm like, wait, you're just completely distorting the statistics. That's like that we've attempted suicide. Yes, because it's hard being trans. Yes, because people don't accept us. Yes. And I know people, it's just like something that you just don't want to, we're real people. You can't like take statistics like suicide when many of us have attempted suicide, have had people who we've lost, and then you take statistics and distort them for some political gain when it's like our real lives, like we're real people. It's like so upsetting to me. Oh, I'm sorry. Give me a second.
It's so upsetting and it's so harmful. Mm-hmm.
This is really hard to talk about because we are real people, just reduced to surgery. And I think, too, what's frustrating for me, too, is that we still have not been able to change the narrative that being trans is about surgery. When Rand Paul was interviewing that Biden appointee, whose name escapes me right now.
Dr. Levine.
Yes, Dr. Levine. When he was interviewing Dr. Levine during her confirmation, he was talking about, you know, genital mutilation, and people still think that being trans is about surgery. I know so many trans people who've never had a surgical procedure in their life, and they're still trans. And so I wish that we can stop thinking about transness in terms of surgery, stop talking about surgery, and just talk about like the human beings and the lived experiences. And that's part of what is so detrimental about the nature of this conservative coverage on trans people. They make it all about bodies and surgery. And they do that to objectify us. They do that to dehumanize us. They misgender us to have the specter of a man in a girl locker room, you know. So the misgendering is to outrage people. And the fact that there's just not enough pushback, I know it's hard to watch. I sat through over the weekend watching a lot of conservative media, and I was sick to my stomach. It's really hard stuff to watch as a real life trans person.
It's that time again. A lot more is coming though. Without further ado.
When I started transitioning in 1998, most of the girls I knew, I went to the doctor, but most of the girls I knew got their hormones from a guy named Ralph, who like came by, you know, I prefer when the girls were in a group so he could sell like to all the girls, but we got our hormones on the street. Like a lot of girls got hormones on the street back in the day. And like denying trans people healthcare is not going to deny us hormones. You know, we're going to get our hormones, right?
And people are going to get it. Yep.
You're not going to stop us from being trans. And the idea is that we want it to be healthy. We want to make sure that trans folks have access to the best care because that's what we deserve. But you're not going to stop us from being trans. Just leave us alone.
Yeah. Leave us alone. Yeah. I mean, that's it. And, you know, we will take care of our people. We will find a way. We will make sure people get the health care that they need, but it will be less safe. It will be, you know, more precarious, and especially for people who aren't as connected to community, people in rural places, people who, you know, don't have access to any money. There are going to be markets for care that are much more dangerous. And that is true when you ban healthcare. It's true when you ban abortion. It's true when you ban hormones. It's just going to be true. But I also want to say, too, in the context of the media, it's the going back to your point about equating trans people with surgery. It's not even just the right-wing media. It's like you can see so many news articles, for example, about these bans on healthcare for trans youth. And they have like a stock image of like a surgeon with a scalpel reinforcing the idea that kids are getting surgery. And again, they're not. You know, and yes, there are a small number of kids who have top surgery who have a various kind. There are not kids getting genital surgery. And there are no kids who are pre-puberty getting surgery, except for the intersex infants who are forced in the surgery.
And I think I want to stop there because I think this is really, really important. Because what's difficult for a lot of people out there is like, well, kids don't know what they want. So let's just say transgender children are not having genital surgery.
Period.
No one, period. Period. Transgender children are not having genital surgery. Period. That you can't do that till you're 18. We're talking puberty blockers and possibly cross-sex hormones when they are indicated. And it's actually none of your business anyway. It should be between the doctor and the parent. And like the fact that we're like having conversations about children's bodies, it's just deeply disturbing to me. It's like when you're a trans kid, your dignity is just taken away. And we need to restore the dignity of trans people. I mean, we have it, but this is why it's hard for me to talk about this, because I always try to be the magnanimous, loving, you know, create the message so people can hear me, Laverne Cox. But this is just fucked up. It is utterly and completely upsetting. There were months when I was like, I'm not going to talk about this. I'm not going to talk about this. This is too much. And then it just kept getting worse and worse and worse. And no one else was talking about it. And here we are. And there's just no pushback. I am so pissed that there's not like this huge outcry that this is happening right now. And I'm honestly pissed at the Democratic Party in general with not just this, with like everything. Like, we have a Democratic president, Senate, and House, and we can't get an Equality Act. We can't get a $15 minimum wage. We can't pass For the People Act. We can't do anything.
Nothing. We're not reforming the court. We are in a intractable, disastrous situation. And I think, the other thing that's always so painful about this is like, all trans people have tried in one way or another to not be trans. And you know what? You know, and that has been one of the most painful part of all of our lives. You do all sorts of soul searching, of self-inquiry, of, you know, is this really who I am? We tried that. It does not work. The only way that we can live is as ourselves. And so it is not a revelation to us to think about not being trans. It is just an impossibility. And so I think that is why in so many ways it's so incredibly painful to feel and experience this mass movement to try to take away our ability and prevent us from being who we are. There's just so much disinformation and false narrative about this notion that it's harmful to be us. Every single type of medicine, like that gender affirmation, medical care that minors get, cis minors get. Puberty blockers are available to cis people for precocious puberty. Hormones are taken all the time for a range of endocrine conditions and other reasons, some of which have everything to do with, you know, one's gender expression. So, for example, cis girls can take testosterone suppression if they have, you know, acne related to testosterone production. I mean, there's a million ways that endocrinologists will prescribe it, and it is simply not harmful. And it is simply being banned for only trans people because the goal, once again, to come back to it, is not to protect anyone. It's to prevent us from being trans.
That's a really interesting point that you make about puberty blockers being prescribed to someone who has a precocious puberty who identifies as cisgender, right? So is there an equal protection argument there when it comes to that a cis boy can get puberty blockers, but a trans girl can't?
Yeah. In Arkansas, for example. So we have, you know, in Arkansas, we're the only state that's actually passed a trans health care ban. We sued them and we got an injunction, a preliminary injunction. And the judge completely could not understand the state's argument. Why can a cis person have this? If you're saying that it's because it's unsafe, why is it safe for the cis minor and not for the trans minor? And they, you know, the judge asked the state, if you read the transcript, it's astounding. I'm not understanding, like, why can the cis minor get testosterone suppression, but the trans minor cannot? Well, it's to treat a different condition. But is it safe or is it not safe? And that, you know, they went in circles. And the judge in our case said, even under rational basis, even under the most deference to the state, you cannot justify this unequal treatment. And the judge ruled that we were likely to prevail on our equal protection claims. On our fundamental rights of parents claims, because these are situations you need parental consent. So the state is overriding what parents believe to be in the best interest of their children. There is a long tradition in this country of respecting the rights of parents to govern the safety, care, and well-being of their children. And then also that we're likely to prevail on our First Amendment claims, because not only does the law ban the care, it bans the referral for the care, which is obviously an intrusion upon the speech of the doctors and the rights of patients and parents to hear information. And so now, you know, the law is not in place because we have an injunction. It's been appealed. So, you know, this is obviously going to be a long fight, but it is such a clear equal protection violation in this case. That is where we are.
So the appeal is going to go to an appellate court. Which court?
The Eighth Circuit. We're going to the Eighth Circuit. And then if we have to, we're going, you know, to the Supreme Court. Obviously, again, though, coming back to the structures that we're dealing with, we're not in a good situation with the courts. We're not in a good situation with state legislatures. And we need drastic change. We need drastic movements for change. You know, without an expanded Supreme Court, we're seeing what's happening at the Supreme Court. Just hoping that it works with this court isn't going to work.
What's really interesting for me is the equal protection piece, the First Amendment piece, the parents' right to govern what they're doing with their children. So the law is clearly on our side, but the law might not matter is what it seems like what we're up against and that what your fear might be, Chase. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah. The fear is, you know, the law is political. Law is whatever the judges say it is. And there's so much misinformation and they are just taking right-wing talking points and repackaging them as constitutional arguments. And I think we have incredible arguments. If there is any justice or legitimacy to the law, then we should win. We should win at every level. It should not even be a close question. But, you know, I never trust these courts. And I think if people are quiet, if we're not making an uproar, then we will lose. Because then the judges are just going to reflexively do what is natural to them, and that is to be scared of trans people. But if we are engaged, if we are countering this media narrative, if we are countering what people are hearing over and over again about trans people, then we can prevail. But it is not simply about arguments made in court, and it's not simply about us in that courtroom. It's about what all of us decide to do in the next year.
Amazing. Thank you for the fight that you wage every single day, Chase. I'm so grateful for you. I'm so grateful for your work at the ACLU and for the ACLU. You are truly invaluable right now. I like to end the podcast with the question that comes from my therapy, my somatic therapy based in the community resiliency model, and it's based on the idea of both and. When there's something challenging in our lives, if there's some pain that we might have in our body, somewhere in our body, it's neutral or positive, and if we can focus on that thing, then we can mitigate the thing that's painful. It's about those things that we can use to get us through. So Chase Strangio, on this day for you, what else is true?
Oh, I mean, I think this is such a good practice. And it is true today, and it is true every day, that I have a life full of trans people and people who love trans people. Mm. And even in these really horrible, depressing, truly dystopian times, I go to bed each night feeling loved and feeling like I have the tools to continue to reflect on how to be a better version of myself the next day. And that's really comforting to me. And I did not always feel that way. And so that is true. And I also, for all the backlash, for all the challenges, you know, we're winning a lot still. And we blocked so many anti-trans laws in court, and I'm so proud of that. Mm-hmm. And we will just keep fighting.
Yeah. That's really beautiful. That's really beautiful. I love you so much, Chase. And what's astounding to me is how, in so many ways, sort of how unassuming you are, but I think you're a legal giant, and I'm really, really happy you're in the world. Thank you for the work. Thank you for your deep, deep knowledge of all this stuff.
I appreciate you.
I love Chase so much. He was my date to the 2019 Emmys, and I had a purse made that said Supreme Court Title VII, October 8th. If we lost that case, they would have made it legal to fire someone for being LGBTQ. And in a 6-3 decision, the LGBTQ plus community, we won that case. Chase was on the legal team that argued that case. Two of the plaintiffs did not survive to hear that verdict in 2020. And here we are in 2021 with all of this slew of bills targeting now trans kids. I'm exhausted, and I'm pissed off. I'm pissed off, and I'm exhausted. These are real people's lives that politicians are playing with. People who are worthy of love. People who are human beings. My brother, I was talking to him about this the other night because I was so anxious about this podcast, and he said, either you believe people are worthy of dignity and respect, or you don't. And I just keep thinking about that. And I just keep thinking about how relentless the dehumanizing of trans people is. And the consequences are dire. 2020 was the deadliest year on record for trans people. I'm talking about trans murders. I want to be in this space of focusing on the positive. There's so much good in the world. I don't want to live in this space of oppression and discrimination. And like, I don't want to be there, but I also don't want to be in denial about what's really happening and the real people who are being affected. And I feel like it's just devastating. People are still dying and people are still experiencing discrimination and having healthcare taken away. And oh. So, yeah. In the show notes, there will be links to the audio that we have referenced in the podcast. So go and listen to the entire interviews. We encourage you to do that. And we encourage you to step into and lean into your own humanity and the humanity of everyone around you, no matter how they identify. Thank you for listening to The Laverne Cox Show. You must join me next week for my conversation with the one and only Valerie Spencer. She's a dear friend, and she is a unique, incredible, empowering voice in LGBTQI plus activism and spirituality. She's the creator of the Holistic Empowerment Institute, an organization which addresses empowerment for LGBTQI plus communities. And she is a full Kiki. Come join us for a psycho-spiritual shift, honey. Please rate, review, and subscribe and share with everyone you know. You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at Laverne Cox and on Facebook at Laverne Cox for real. Until next time, stay in the love. The Laverne Cox Show is a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from Shondaland Audio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.